Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Along with Mel, K2KEY, we run a thing called the Technical Met. The Technical Met is the gathering of the clan, the ham radio clan, the people who are interested in the details of how ham radio works and how to make it work better. Lots of questions get answered. Not all of them. Lots of questions get asked. Most of them get answered by somebody who shows up with some little piece of information. And we find out a lot more about how to make this hobby more enjoyable, what rigs to buy, what antennas to use, what transmission lines, how do they work. A lot of details. The books only partially cover the subject. And a little bit later, I'll tell you a bit of a philosophy decision I've made this week, and about what we're doing, what we're going to continue to be doing, what people are appreciating. We're getting quite a bit of feedback as to what has been happening for the last couple of weeks. And I'll tell you about that. For the time being, I'm going to take check-ins to the TechNet for people who think they've got a question or a comment on what's going on in their lives right now with ham radio and opinions about last week and what they would like to know about today. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this. N2NNU, Alex from Yonkers, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name at this time. And that, yes, K2RIW listening.
Whiskey 2 Echo, Whiskey Kilo, Eugene, no comment. Listening.
And 2APG, Dave, and yes.
W2RY, Joe. Yes.
K2DO, Diane, Syosset, just listening.
K2KEY, and boy, did I get slaughtered this week with emails, Dick, and phone calls. I'll tell you about that later.
So did I, Mel. And boy, that's what made me come to a conclusion. Okay, so far we've got Eugene, Joe, Diane, let's see, Dave. I think those are the ones that have signed in so far. Did I miss anyone? And who else would like to sign in? Give me a call letters and name.
2 UPP, Mike, talk about, just listening, comment.
K2 MDP, Steve, no questions.
Okay, a very noisy Peter, Mike, and Steve. We got you guys. One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Particularly those who've got a question or a comment, give me your call letters, name, and that word yes. K2RIW and Mel, listening.
Kilo Echo Victor Delta, Brian, no questions.
Okay, Brian recognized with a no. I think the first person who signed in with a yes, let's see now, I may have it upside down. I believe it was Dave, N2APG. N2APG, Dave and yes. This is the way he usually signs his emails to me. What's on your alleged mind today, Dave? He's a guy that can take some ribbing. These guys in Massapequa, they're tough. Go ahead, Dave.
Absolutely, N2APG, Dave and yes, in Massapequa. Got a quick question on digital TV. Went out and picked up a converter box last week. Hooked it up. Set it up, all that good stuff. I'm getting, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 channels come in on it. But noticeably absent are any of the CBS channels. And also channel 13 is noticeably absent. I'm just wondering if that's normal for the time being. I don't know what their, you know, transmitter setups are. You know, all that good stuff. I'm using a pretty decent TV antenna, which is up topside, served me well for the last 20-25 years, and it's, you know, it's still working well on the analog signal. So that's my quick question. I'm just wondering if the CBS channels and channel 13 are up to snuff right now. Is there any reason why I wouldn't be picking those up?
Okay, we just happen to have an expert named Joe, W2RYY, who for a number of weeks has been traveling around with portable antennas and his service monitor, new used in the spectrum analyzer mode with and without digital television converters. And I think he's told me he's gotten something like 35 channels of digital television. So we're eventually going to pass it over to Joe. You've answered my first question of what are you using for an antenna? Sounds to me like it's a rooftop antenna. The rooftop antenna you've had for a lot of years. Is that fed with coax or twin lead? Almost no one uses twin lead anymore, but that coax, how old is it? Because the best coax I know of is RG6/SAT, sold by Radio Shack. Inexpensive coax, but high-end performance. That's the good news. The bad news is that that is a foam-filled, low-loss coax, flexible cable, which under some circumstances is very good at sucking up moisture slowly through the outer jacket, and as such, the insertion loss in dB per foot or per 100 foot can climb to some pretty high numbers. And that would be a very subtle thing that's kind of hard to detect. If your cable had 10 dB of extra loss, and it would cut down, drastically cut down the number of digital television signals you can watch, it's a very hard thing to detect, because even if you had the right instrumentation to measure the standing wave ratio of the antenna, because of its loss, it acts like a good dummy load, and the standing wave ratio will be good. To measure antenna efficiency is difficult. About the only way I know of that you can get a hint is to say, of the strongest channels you work that are in front of that antenna on the roof, if there's some kind of a bar chart, some kind of a signal strength indicator on your digital television converter and your display box, what did you see? On the channels that you did get, name a channel and did the bar chart go up to number 30 or up to number 90, if you know what I mean, that day. So give us a couple of words on what you believe is the condition of your transmission line of the antenna. If I took out a pair of binoculars and I looked at your antenna, is it missing elements? Because it's been around for a few years. Do you think it's in good shape? Think it's got a good feed line? And of the digital channels you watch, what kind of...
Repeater, timeout.
Of the digital channels you watch, what kind of signal strength indicators did you get? And when it comes to no channel 13, I know Joe is going to... When I pass it over to Joe, I know he's going to have an explanation for you on that one. So
I'm here often.
I thought so. Of those couple of questions I've asked you, let me pass it to you first, Dave, and to APG, the microwave voice of Massapequa, K2RIW. You got it, Dave.
Okay. The antenna's in good shape. No missing elements. It's all intact. It works very well on analog, no problem. The feed line is twin lead. That's also in good shape. And like I say, it works, you know, quite well on analog. I get all of the regular analog stations. The antenna is pointed due west towards New York City. I haven't had enough time to play around as far as the bar graph meter. I did notice that, you know, there's one in there. But I haven't really, like I said, I just hooked it up last week. And I really haven't been... had a chance to sit down and document everything as far as signal strength and stuff like that. But like I said, I just noticed very quickly that there were no CBS stations coming in and no channel 13. So that was my immediate question. You know, whether or not those digital transmitters are up to snuff. Perhaps they're on low power right now, you know, and maybe that's why I'm not picking them up.
I'm relatively sure that channel 13 in your locale is going to be troublesome for a while, but that's going to be cleared. Now, let me first pass it over to Joe, and then to Eric in that order. I'm pretty sure Eric is on frequency. Joe, I think I remember you saying that you've traveled around, and with your home antenna, your QTH antenna, I think you've told me numbers like 30 and 40 digital channels total. And my guess is channel 13, which I think is really on channel 68, or is it 63, is a very troublesome one. Not very strong, quite far away, high in frequency where, it's the highest one in frequency where it experiences the most amount of attenuation from foliage and whatever. And also, there is the temporary antenna problem at the Empire State Building. So Joe, let's get a couple of words from you as to what you think Dave should be seeing in Massapequa. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. W-2-R-Y-Y, you may turn down the radio down 7 feedback here.
Okay, I'm located out in Sableton. I'm about 46 miles from Midtown Manhattan. The antenna I have is a fairly high gain antenna. I have a preamp that's massive amount, so I get a lot of gain out of the thing. I can't pick up channel 13 also out of here. It's too low for the converter to catch. It's about 12 dB below the average signal of the other DTB channels. Some are higher, but that one's about the lowest one. The other station out there, Massapequa, I would ask you this. If you look at channels 25, 31, 41, 47, and 68 in analog mode, do they all come in very clear, reasonably clear, or just a moderate picture? How would you rate those?
Over to you, Dave, for that one. Okay. The channels that he mentioned, off the top of my head, I would say most of those come in fair, you know, not strong, but in the medium section, in between someplace. And also just a follow up regarding amplifiers. I was using one of those broadband amplifiers, I don't know, 20 dB gain, quote unquote, you know, from Radio Shack. And I was also wondering, would that be applicable, would that be usable for digital signals? You know, would that be something I would want to put in line as I had it before? At the present time, I took it out of the line, so it's not in there. It's just the antenna feeding the converter box. But those stations that you mentioned, those UHF stations, they come in fair.
You've got it, Joe.
Okay, I get all those stations off the outside antenna. I get some interference behind them, like either specks across the channels or something like that. But as far as the picture quality, I would rate them like about 90% of the picture quality of cable. That's how strong they're coming in. That's what kind of amplitude you need to get the digital signals. If you're getting a moderate TV picture, only probably the very strongest digital channels are going to come through. They either come through or they don't. There's really no in between with the thing. I have, at times, from my current location with the antenna just pointing in one direction, I've got as high as 56 separate digital channels already.
Wow. 56 digital channels from Fayetteville. That antenna of yours, roughly how many elements and how many feet above the ground in Fayetteville on the South Shore is that antenna with its preamplifier fed into coax cable? How far above the ground and how big is that antenna?
Hey, Dick.
Joe, I'll get to you. Don't worry. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, but let's be fair. How is he counting channels?
Okay. Good point. Good point, Eric. Go ahead, Joe.
I know just what he's going to say. You can take a channel from, say, like channel 29. Channel 29 has 10 subchannels in it. I'm counting them as subchannels, not individual RF channels.
Okay. Individual RF channels, not counting subchannels. How many real channels do you think you've got, Joe?
I would say, let's see, I can pick up channels. I can tell you which ones I can pick up out of New York. 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11. Can't pick up 13. Of course, I can pick up 21. I can pick up 25, 31, 41, 47, and 68, all digital. They come in all the time.
And, Joe, that antenna is how big and how far above the ground in Sable? And to me, Sable is not high land. It's South Shore. My guess is your house might be 50 feet above sea level. Over to you, Joe.
Ground elevation is approximately 25 feet above sea level, and the antenna is approximately 25 to 30 feet above the ground. The exact number of elements, I don't recall exactly. It's somewhere around maybe 30 elements, something like that. There's more in UHF than there are in VHF. But combined, it's a channel 7 through 13 and 14 through 69 as far as the coverage. The amplifier I have does give me a little bit of a boost. It has 17 dB gain on VHF and 28 dB gain for the rated for on UHF, so that's a big help.
Did you ever try how many digital television channels you get without the preamp? And what you're describing as to the length of that television aerial, 25 feet above your ground, it sounds to me like it's intended as a reasonably deep fringe television receiving antenna. So am I correct in guessing what kind of an antenna? And did you ever try without the preamp just to find out what the difference was? Over to you, Joe.
No, I didn't try that to preamp. I could do that, but it's really not a lot of sense for me to do that. But I could do that sometime and get back to it with the results. The digital channel typically come in about, I'm talking to your terms here, the pilot carriers on most of the digital channels are typically minus 60 to minus 70 dBm, which is more than enough to make the digital decoder detected okay. Channel 61, which is digital channel 13, is typically about minus 85 to 90 dBm, too much for the decoder, it's too low for the decoder to handle. That's after the amplifier, that's what I currently see right now.
And you're reading those dBms off of the spectrum analyzer function of a service monitor, minus 80 or minus 90 for what is channel 13, really channel 63 UHF TV. That's well below threshold of your digital converter. Would you guess that your digital converter will demodulate the signal at around minus 70 dBm? Rough guess, is that the right ballpark, Joe?
Yes, I would say it pretty much works that way. I have what's equivalent to the Zenith, the DT-901. I have the Insignia. It's the same thing. It's made by Best Buy carriers. It's made by, I guess, LG. So I got two of those. They work the same. They seem to be about anything about minus 85 to 90 is the cutoff point with those things. They don't really want to respond too much below that as far as the kept from the carrier levels I've measured. If it's about minus 80 or higher, the thing will lock up. Sometimes, if the signal's even higher, they have a little bit of trouble locking up sometimes, because I guess there's maybe multipath coming in or other various other extraneous factors. But just pushed by raw signal level, 80 to 85 seems to be about the cutoff point. If it's below that, it's going to be troublesome sometimes.
Okay, what we've been finding out over the last few weeks on digital television is that a certain amount of signal strength, obvious by a good antenna aimed in the right direction, is a necessary but not sufficient. I'll pick a number out of the air. Minus 75 or so dBm of signal strength is required. Step number one. Step number two, a moderate amount, not an excessive amount, of multipath. If you were watching a UHF analog television channel, you would know multipath is there because you would see ghosting. Ghosting means that you would see the exact same picture displaced to the right of the main picture, and that's called ghosting. And a certain amount of ghosting is essentially intolerable for the currently available digital television demodulators. As they get smarter and as they get better to third, fifth, and seventh generation, they can tolerate more and more. There is a equalizer network built into the digital demodulator that can tolerate the multipathing, the delayed signal. When you get digital signal components laying on top of each other, displaced in time, it's called inter-symbol distortion. And there's only a certain amount of inter-symbol distortion that a poor demodulator can tolerate before it says, I give up, that is mishmash, I'm going to give you nothing. Now, a man who works in the television broadcast industry and can tell us more about what we're seeing, what we should expect to see, how much better it's going to get in the future, how many television channels are out there right now. Our local expert is Eric, KE2EJ, who represents the best in public television broadcasting on Channel 13 and Channel 21. Eric, what's your take on all of this and what poor Dave is running into in Massapequa, or very few digital television signals at this time, on what he thinks is a medium good television receiving aerial? KE2EJ, K2RAW in the second half.
K2RAW, KE2EJ. All right, the first thing for the gentleman in Massapequa is you're not going to get to Channel 13, not until June 12th. Then it will be on VHF 13, you won't have a problem. They're only running about, maybe about 680 watts into the antenna, whereas everybody else is running considerably a lot more power. And just for your information, channels 2, 4, 7, 11, and 13 are all on the same antenna. So you're getting differences between where you can't pick up 56, which is 2. You may find that actually you're going to have to rotate your antenna a little bit and find a happy spot where you get everything. The twin lead doesn't bother me far enough away. It's not going to be an issue. Although the nature of digital is interesting, and I'm hearing minus 75, minus 80 dBm, that's quite a sensitive receiver converter. I mean, look, minus 75, now most of those things are rated in dBmV. You know, we can go through the conversion, make a little calculator here. So minus 75 is minus 26.2 dBmV, which is like really a hot receiver. Most receivers aren't really happy unless they see minus 20 or better. The intended input of the receiver is zero. So you can kind of figure it from there. Let me drop. And the aiming issue in New York, now there's other folks listening to it. I see there's a couple of, there's a California station repeater and two Nevada stations listening to it. In New York, which is different than other places, they all have their individual kinds of problems. But here, we have a, it's what I would call an error that was made in the transmission system, was that up until about 6 months ago, people didn't have problems, like in Massapequa were picking up Channel 13. But I'm not really going to get into that, but the broadcasters are basically making their own problem. They're making it harder for the receivers to work properly. Back to you, Dick, K2IWK2J.
Yeah, you take, for instance, Alex up in Yonkers, into NNU. He gets lots of digital channels, no sweat. Even Channel 13, because he's essentially north of the Empire State Building and the northern direction, Empire State Building's working pretty nice. To my knowledge, there is a so-called fill-in antenna, a second antenna system at a different location on the Empire State Building, which is intended to fill in the area under the umbrella. By that I mean your main television broadcast aerial on top of the mast on the Empire State Building is squirting its antenna, which is a pancake pattern omnidirectional antenna with a very narrow vertical beam width. It's squirting that energy out to the horizon to give you high range. However, the people who are in close, and say, for instance, western Brooklyn, are under the umbrella of that antenna pattern and not getting good coverage. So a secondary antenna to fill in was added. But that's a temporary fix, and that antenna is putting out a signal that is not exactly in the same time domain as the main antenna. Therefore, it's creating temporarily a kind of multipath within the transmission signal system. And there's no simple way of correcting that right now, but it will be corrected in June. So this is a temporary condition from my point of view. Now, one of the things that's scaring me a little bit, Dave, is that if I walked into the average electronics store today and tried to buy 300-ohm twin lead, I'm not so sure I can do that. I think it's almost a discontinued product. That tells me that the twin lead you're using could be a decade old. And I know for a fact that the twin lead that I used to use on both 432 megacycles and my television aerial, eventually the rubber dries out, cracks, sucks up a lot of moisture and dirt and whatever in those cracks between the twin lead, and so the twin lead can become quite lossy. And so that could be an aggravating factor, that if you got around to making sure you've got a good clean aerial, good clean contacts to it, and fresh modern day coax to that aerial, that could make a significant improvement. Let me pass it back to you, Dave, and so you may have some further questions on what you've heard so far. Hang in there, Dave. It's going to get better. And you're one of the guys at the leading edge making sure he's getting digital television. Massapequa is a nice town, but it's essentially west of the Empire
repeater. Time out.
It's essentially west of the Empire State Building where this fill-in antenna multipath problem is about the worst from what I've been hearing. And as I said, that's going to eventually get better. And to APG, any further questions or discussions? And what do you believe is the age of your 300-ohm twin lead? And to APG, K2RIW.
All right, K2RIW and to APG returning. Appreciate all the comments and the info. The twin lead is probably 15 to 20 years old at least. It is a good quality twin lead. I have been up on the roof a couple of times, you know, in a few years prior. It's still in good shape. I'll check it again this year. I'm going to go up on the roof as it gets a little warmer and stuff, and certainly going to aim the antenna with that, you know, the bar graph meter and stuff like that. I suspect it's a couple of degrees, a little bit too low to the south. In other words, I think everything's up on Empire right now, so I'm probably going to have to just tweak it a little bit further north. But you know, it can't be terribly off. It might be off by 10 degrees, something like that. So, from what Eric said, I believe things are going to get better. I know, obviously, they're still in a transition period. Everybody's not up to, up to snuff, and things will get better. So that's encouraging. The only question that wasn't answered is the what about the use of the broadband distribution amp? Would that still be helpful on the digital frequency?
Dick?
Who said Dick?
Me.
Go ahead, Eric.
Hi. Be very careful about preamps. Preamps can be a very good thing, but they can fool you, depending upon what you're picking up. Some preamps are very sensitive to local FM stations and cause all sorts of intermodulation distortions. You've got to watch out what you're using. You really should measure what's going into it before you put it into it, okay? And if you're fortunate enough to have a spectrum analyzer, look at what you're starting with. Look at what comes out, because distortion is a very easy thing to see on digital signals if enabled. But yeah, it can be a very useful thing, and it can be a hindrance depending upon, you know, whether you have weak versus strong signals and how they interact with each other. So there are situations where people have a preamp and they actually have a bypass, which bypasses for some channels and turn it on for others. So, and to pointing, the difference of 1 degree can mean the difference between having a picture or not. So, you know, there is no such thing in digital as sort of like being just a little bit off. So, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've got at least two comments here, Dave. Number one, I know for a fact that 15-year-old Twinly is well beyond the life of where, under normal circumstances, you get high performance out of Twinly. That poor piece of rubber in between those two wires has been exposed to ultraviolet sunlight on 15 consecutive seasons, day in and day out. Guarantee it's been beat up. No matter how good it looks to your eye, RF-wise, I know it's sucking up moisture and has extra loss. And there may even be some broken wires inside that are not obvious because of the way it's waving in the wind. So the twin lead itself is a little bit suspect. When you put a preamp in front of it to drive it, the insertion loss of the twin lead becomes much less of an issue. I also like Eric's suggestion that if you can get a hold of a spectrum analyzer function of a service monitor or borrow somebody's spectrum analyzer and look what's coming out of your twin lead, it'll give you a hint as to how much success you're going to get with that preamp. If you look across the frequency region from, I'm going to pick a number, 45 megacycles to 650 megacycles. If you look across that frequency region, if there's a couple of very strong local signals, police, fire, taxi cab dispatching, oil dispatching, and whatever, they're going to give you some grief. If there's an FM broadcast station, which is on the air, you know, at least 12 hours a day, and it's really potent in there, that's going to give you some grief unless you put in a suck-out filter. The preamplifier can easily give you 15 or 20 dB of gain and overcome a lot of insertion loss and pick you up a lot of extra sensitivity. That's the good news. But most preamps in general work from DC to light, so to speak. They work from the 40 meg region to the 600 meg region. And if there's any strong signal in there which subs the preamplifier into 1 dB of compression, and even though it's in 1 dB of compression at, let's say, 155 megacycles from some commercial service, if it's 1 dB in compression at that frequency, the laws of physics indicate that the preamplifier will be in 1 dB of compression at every frequency simultaneously, even on weak signals. Therefore, that compression characteristic, when we drop, is creating a degree of nonlinearity, which means that what you call preamplifier is giving you some gain, that's the good news, and 1 dB less of it because of the compression. If it had 19 dB of gain before the compression, now it's got 18 dB of gain at all frequencies, that's the good news. But it is a beautiful mixer, taking every single frequency you got and mixing it together with every other frequency that's there in an M by N product, making intermods all over the place. You shove any electronic device into the compression region, it becomes nonlinear at all frequencies, even for weak signals. So that can give you some really peculiar things. Now, so quality of your twin lead, what the preamplifier is going to be experiencing, even if you don't have a spectrum analyzer. And hey, the preamplifier ain't that expensive. Give it a try. You're a guy that has no trouble climbing the roof. Install it. Find out what happens. And if it's worse, it's worse. You can take it back out again. Consider also putting a rotator on that antenna. You didn't need it on analog. You do need it on digital. There are rotators out there that are only $50 or so, and they work like a charm. I forget what brand name it was. We went down this oil, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks ago. There are rotators out there you can buy that are well under $100 that are high-end performance. And the nature of digital television is that the nature of the individual multipass, their exact phase and their exact amplitude, sometimes is very persnickety into that demodulator circuit, the digital converter. And so moving the antenna 2 degrees, which makes no difference in the amplitude of the signal you get from Empire State Building, but makes minor differences in the multipass signals you get, and all of a sudden the converter says, aha, I'm happy. You've lowered the multipass by 3 dB, and the main signal didn't change, and all of a sudden I can demodulate. So consider adding both the preamp and the rotator, as well as possibly someday converting over to brand new transmission line. 15 years on twin lead, you're a guy who likes economy, and you've gotten your money's worth out of that twin lead, Dave. And I'm curious as to whether or not twin lead is even still purchasable. I think it's almost a discontinued product. N2APG, K2LAW in the TechNet.
N2APG returning. Well, as a crafty ham, I have a stockpile of twin lead. Hi. Over the last couple of years, I have picked up twin lead as I've come across it at flea markets and garage sales and stuff like that. So that's not a problem. If I decide to change out the twin lead, I have a decent supply of fresh twin lead that can be used. So very, very fine on all that. And just another comment. A couple of days ago, this is changing the subject from the digital TV, I went hiking with my brother, and we went up to Mount Beacon. And lo and behold, we get up on the top of the mountain. I said, wow, look at that. There's a whole bunch of towers up there. So that was quite interesting. Of course, I didn't know in advance that we were going to Mount Beacon, so I hadn't prepared as far as amateur radio frequencies and repeaters. Mount Beacon Amateur Radio Club apparently is very active. They have a number of repeaters on that site, but of course, I didn't do my homework because I didn't know we were going there. But that's quite an interesting site.
Had you been there before, and is this a recent installation, or this is the first time you've been on Mount Beacon? Because I do remember ham radio operators way back 25, 30 years ago talking about putting 2-meter repeaters on Mount Beacon. So is this new to you because you're seeing it for the first time, or these are new antennas because you're on Mount Beacon for the second time? Over to you, Dave.
New to me because I've never been on Mount Beacon. Apparently they've been up there for quite some time. Now, Mount Beacon Amateur Radio Club has a nice website. They have numerous repeaters, you know, on all the different bands, apparently up on that site, as well as some other auxiliary sites. And the elevation where the main transmitters are, there's two mountains that are, you know, right close to one another. One is Mount Beacon, and one is South Mount Beacon. The summit where the antennas are is Mount Beacon. That's about 1,200 feet elevation. And the towers on top of that vary in height, you know, maybe from 150 to about maybe 300 max. So they're up there pretty good. They're up there about 1,200. Now, South Mount Beacon, which is just maybe, I don't know, half a mile or a mile south of the main Mount Beacon, that's actually higher. That's about 1,600 feet elevation. Unfortunately, the road doesn't go up to South Mount Beacon, and the summit is a much smaller area. So on top of South Mount Beacon, there's an old fire tower that sits there all by itself at the 1,600-foot level. And that's in disrepair. You could still climb it if you want, but I didn't go up it. I felt that 1,600 feet was high enough.
I bet you wished you had a set of handy talkies on 2 meters and 450 and 6 meters with you. I'll bet you could have talked back to Limark and other repeaters on Long Island. How many chunks of electronics did you have with you? And by the way, taking a hike like that in the woods, it'd be nice to have cell phone and other kinds of protection where, if need be, you could holler Mayday. So how much electronics was in your pocket that you, or in your backpack when you went up there, Dave? Go ahead.
Well, of course you want to try to keep it light because, you know, the more stuff you... Let me tell you, it was... this was quite a vertical climb. You really weren't going too much east-west, so to speak, but the vertical climb, you're going from ground level and you're climbing up to the 1,200-foot level. It's very steep, so quite a lot of exertion, you know, going up and coming down. As far as electronics, a cell phone, a dual-band handy-talkie, which I did utilize to get back on the island with, speaking, you know, back on the local repeaters here on the island, so that was no problem. And we also carry Muir's radios. Those are the inexpensive VHF radios. We carry those just in case we get separated on the mountain. We can still keep in touch, you know, between the hikers.
Give me a couple of words on these Muir's radios. What band are they on? What kind of range do they have? How many dollars does a pair of them cost? Over to you, Dave.
Muir's is amazing. They're five itinerant business frequencies. They used to be business band license required frequencies. Now they're non-licensed frequencies, five of them. 151 megahertz, 154 megahertz. Muir's didn't really take off too well. Everybody knows GMRS. Everybody knows FRS. They're UHF. The Muir's is VHF. You can get a pair of Muir's radios, if you can find them. They're kind of hard to find. I pick them up at the flea markets, $20, $30 for a pair. They're inexpensive, they're plastic, they look very cheesy, but the performance is phenomenal. The radios I have, they have all five frequencies in them. They also has the weather band in there for receive. They have PL, ENCODE, DECODE. What else do they have? Vox. So, you know, they're full-featured little radios. Unfortunately, the case is plastic. It's cheesy plastic. But performance-wise, I think they put out about 2 watts max. It has a low and a high power setting. Low power is probably a couple hundred milliwatts. High power might be a watt and a half, maybe 2 watts. But amazing range. They work amazingly well.
Would you guess they're good for about 2 miles? And what kind of a battery do they run on, Dave?
These use 4 AA's, and I would say easily 2 miles without too much problem, especially, you know, in open conditions. Probably at the beach or over water, 5 to 10.
And have you ever had trouble with QR Mary, other people on the frequency, or from your point of view, is it almost a private channel between you and your brother?
Most of the time, there's nobody on the frequency. Mind you, there still are commercial users that are still on those frequencies from 10, 15, 20 years ago when they were commercially licensed frequencies. So if you listen on those five frequencies, you will hear people talking, you know, back and forth on occasion. But when you're in the woods someplace, you're hiking, most of the time there's nobody on there.
If I was comparing the performance and weight and whatever of your Muir's radios on your favorite frequency as opposed to a pair of IC2ATs with the 2 ampere hour battery pack on them where I could choose my own private channel on a pair of IC2ATs, which of those two radios would you choose, Dave? Go ahead.
What's the criteria? Performance, weight, what are we talking about?
Anything you want to use as a criteria. If you had the choice of Muir's versus a pair of IC2ATs in good shape with lots of great big batteries on them, or small batteries if you want. The nice thing about the IC2AT is it's got 800 channels. Every 5 KC from 144 to 148, before you modify it, it goes even beyond that. So lots and lots of frequencies there you can choose for your own private channel. So if you want privacy, medium range of a mile or two to talk between two guys that are out hiking, and reliability of batteries and range and all that kind of jazz and weight, would there be a difference? Would you choose one over the other?
Well, I'm a fan of the 2ATs. I have a bunch of them. They're great radios. Unfortunately, they're amateur radios. I can't give one of those to my brother and tell him to talk to me on there. That's illegal. I can give him a Muir's radio. No license required. Performance-wise, again, about the same power output. You're talking about 2 watts on both radios. Performance-wise, they're probably very similar. The Muir's radios have PL, ENCODE, DECODE, the weather frequencies on there, and they use AA batteries. You run out of, gets low, you slap another set of double A's in there. You don't have to carry, proprietary NICAT pack. So, you know, I like the 2ATs. The 2AT is probably five times heavier than the MERS radio.
You told me what I wanted to know. I see why you're using them. Sounds like a smart choice to me. And with any further questions or comments on all of Dave's subjects, give me a call letters right now. Thank you for checking in, Dave. K2LIW on the TechNet.
K2LIW.
I heard a very hummy signal that said K2R and then nothing. Want to give it another try?
K2IS.
Okay, K2IR. Heavily distorted, but I think with my earphones, I'll figure out what you're saying. K2 India Radio, go right ahead.
India Foxtrot. The audio sounds really bad.
The audio sounds really bad. It's got about 30% total harmonic distortion. It's got hum and whine in the background. It is more noise than audio, and I'm figuring out what you're saying by way of the earphones, and you can tell I even got your call letters wrong. Go ahead.
Pass it on to the next.
Yeah, I hope you get a chance to make a change in that radio. If need be, you may have to bring it to Andy, WA2CDL, at one of his tune-up clinics, and he can raise a phoenix from the dead, if you know what I mean. He has in the past taken some really troubled radios that were really sick and brought them back to life. Alrighty. I think the next person who signed in was Joe, W2RYY. Hey, Joe, what kind of digital television research you been doing these days? What's new in the Sable neighborhood? W2RYY, K2RYW on the TechNet.
Well, I have a question, but it's not related to digital TV, but I have a comment on to the last subject, though, just before you close it out. Channel 55, at least in one spot near me, is producing a digital carry that's actually pretty strong in amplitude. It's stronger than most of the stuff that's coming out of New York City. It doesn't bother my television reception, but that might have a bearing if there's another transmitter site producing that information out on the air that might be affecting his reception of Channel 2, which is digital Channel 56, because it's right next to him. And if you look at their information on it with a spectrum analyzer, it looks just like a DTV signal, but the DTV signal, what it looks like, it's not, the decoder ignores it, it doesn't see it whatsoever. And also going back to this effect I saw these channels being flat and unflat, the observation that you thought that was like a one-day type of thing, they're all the same way, they all have the same kind of shallowing of the going across the spectrum, going about almost 20 dB down, so that didn't change. Apparently, that's what looks like that's coming from the transmitter site is being produced by some interaction between the two of the main antenna and the other antenna that's for other purposes it's causing an effect out here. And channel two happens to be one of the channels that has that effect happening to it right now.
Kilo Delta two Bravo Delta.
Kilo Delta two Bravo Delta. Pick you up in a second. Yeah, you were telling us around 2.3 megacycles, 2.36 megacycles, as I remember, of scalloping rate and 20 dB notches across the barkhead spectrum of each one of your digital channels is what you were seeing, which strongly suggests a kind of multipath. And I guess 2.3 megacycles, I could figure out what that is in cable length difference or signal path length difference, and maybe that's the length of the difference in the transmission lines of the so-called fill antenna versus the main broadcast antenna. Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Delta, you have a question or a comment with reference to this, and then I'm going to come back to Joe. Bravo Delta first, go ahead. Give me your name, I should know it.
Roger, thanks, Dick. Name is John, Juliet Oscar Hotel, November. Yeah, just a quick comment for, I think, what Joe was just saying, that he's seeing a signal on 55 with a spectrum analyzer on UHF channel 55. That is not a digital television signal. That is Qualcomm's media flow signal meant to televise or bring a portable television to handheld devices that I believe is broadcast off four times square, but that's not a DTV signal, though it probably sort of looks that way, minus the pilot carrier. K2RAW and the TechNet from Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta.
Very fine, John. Thank you for that information. Okay, Joe, I know you've got You wanted to make this comment, and you probably have some others, and a real question. W2RYY. Take your time. K2RIW.
And it was 2.53 kilohertz, not 2.3. I think you figured that out last week, of that being approximately 100 meters in wavelength, or about 300 foot, which might be the difference between the two antennas on Empire. So that looks like that's pretty much answered that. My question for you, which is not a DTV question, it's basically, maybe it's a simple question, is how, and I don't know how much it has to do with amateur radios, how do you terminate fiber optic cable? What's the proper way of doing that?
And when you say properly terminate, notice that you don't get triple transit phenomena. A fiber optic cable, just like a coaxial cable, if it's not properly terminated, you get standing wave ratio. And the standing wave ratio is going to give you ghosting. And the ghosting is going to give you inter-symbol distortion, and so on. So just like your 50-ohm cable, you make sure that what's on the far end, if it's an antenna, it's a 50-ohm antenna at your favorite frequency. Otherwise, you're going to have standing wave ratio. And if there's also simultaneously a standing wave ratio at the transmitter, and there almost always is a standing wave ratio at your transmitter. That's a tough one to accept. If you use the right kind of instrumentation, and you look at not S11, that's the reflection coefficient of an antenna, you look at S22, what is the reflection coefficient of a signal being rammed back into the output end of a transmitter? You look at the reflection coefficient of a transmitter. Because most of our transmitters, if they're solid state, are nearly a constant current generator. If they're a tube, they're nearly a constant current generator. Yeah, you adjust it with the Pi network, if you've got one, to a 50-ohm output load. In other words, it gives best performance. It is power matched for 50 ohms. It is not impedance matched for 50 ohms. So whenever you have a signal reflected from your antenna that comes back to the transmitter will take 90% of that signal and re-reflect it forward. So therefore, you've got triple transit at least, if not multiple transits, in your feed line. Well, something almost as bad as that can happen on fiber. If the fiber is not properly terminated with a fiber load, there's going to be reflections in the fiber. Now, one of the guys who has worked with fiber, I think Eric has, and I bet you he can give us a lot more information on this. I just recently had a fiber installation at my house, and I asked the technician doing the installation a few of these questions. And he says, I plug it in here, and I screw it down here, and I put this kind of a screw here, I put that kind of a tie wrap there, and this is the way I'm told to do it. He didn't quite know the physics of what he's doing. But Eric does know the physics of what he's doing. I wonder if people have discussed that exact subject, Eric, of proper termination. I know that the lapped joint has to be done rather precisely at the end of the fiber in order for it to be seized correctly. KE2EJ for any comments on this one. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout.
You've got it, Eric, if you're there. Okay, I think Eric is, I think he's on duty tonight, so he's going to be popping in and popping out. I've worked with fiber optics at the Romeo Development Center, but not directly. In other words, you've got these two mountains a mile and a half apart. One mountain has a whole great big set of receiving sites. The other mountain has a whole bunch of transmitting sites in which they put full-size, abandoned or reclaimed aircraft, Air Force aircraft. The Romeo Development Center owns one of every kind of aircraft the Air Force has ever built. And so if you want to know what your antennas will perform like when installed on an F-15 Eagle fighter aircraft, they install the antenna on an F-15 Eagle fighter aircraft, mounted on their pedestal 35 feet in the air with a great big crane, and start rotating that whole darn aircraft, and look at the signals that are picked up a mile and a half away. Beautiful setup. Arguably one of the world's best antenna ranges, and I worked there for 4 years. Most beautiful fun I've ever had in my whole life. As an antenna engineer, a real fun place. And everything is reconnected through that mile and a half range of mountains by way of fiber. So by way of the fiber optics, they're sending signals to the source mountain where you tell it, during this millisecond, I want you to transmit on that frequency with this power output with that antenna. And over the next 5 milliseconds, I want you to flip over to that antenna and that frequency and that polarization. And so the computer on Mountain A is talking to the hardware on Mountain B, ordering it to hop in frequency, hop in transmission, hop in polarization, use this antenna, and so on. As you're rotating the aircraft, you're gathering a tremendous amount of data with that kind of a setup, all hooked up by fiber. And the nice thing about fiber is you can send terabits of data back and forth rather easily, as long as it's set up correctly. And the stuff has got a couple of dB of loss per mile. You try doing that with coaxial cable, and you go crazy. You try to do that wirelessly, you'll never get the bandwidth, and you get multipath, and so on. So the world is going to be fiber. All of us are going to have fiber to the curb, if not fiber to the house. I've got fiber to the house, and right at my house is where it converts over to other kinds of wire, coaxial and twisted pair, so to speak. So I have fiber to the house as of last February. So I know that proper termination is required so that all the signals get there and so that you don't get reflected.
Repeater, time out.
But to answer your really direct question, how do you do that? I guess all I got to say is you use the right hardware, you do it carefully, you make sure you got lap joints. It turns out that what they do in the field, Joe, is that they've got a zillion different jumper lengths of fiber. In other words, if you need a 3-foot, a 6-foot, or a 40-foot jumper to go from the masthead of your house across the street, in my case, over to the junction box that's on the nearest utility pole on the other side of the street, there was a particular length of jumper cable, fiber, that they had where the joints are all previously prepared, and they just basically choose the right one, plug it in, had a little bit of extra length on one side. They made a service loop and held it together with white tie wraps. And I said to you guys, do you realize what you're using? You're using white tie wraps outdoors where it's going to be exposed to the ultraviolet, and therefore it's going to turn into powder in a year. And inside my house, the smaller ones you use are the black tie wraps, which are made for ultraviolet exposure. You guys got it backwards. And they looked at me like a deer in the headlights. What the hell are you talking about? It was an interesting day. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W on the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, no, I've heard about the Verizon installation people that they basically come out to your house ahead of time, will say, okay, I need 125 feet of fiber cable going from point A to point B, and when they come back to install it, that's what they come with, because these guys don't splice the stuff in the field. That, I've heard, is an art all in itself, how to splice fiber cable, so they don't do that. They're all pre-made length. But I just thought that, you know, that if it was a, you know, there was some sort of other art to, you know, terminating something properly or something like that. That's why I asked the question, basically.
John, good question. As far as your digital television research and reception is concerned, from your point of view, is that an ongoing project and you're going to be watching as the changes take place at the Empire State Building? Is it a temporarily completed project for the time being? Or are you collecting other hardware to do even more of your research? Over to you, Joe.
Well, Dick, being that ham like I am for over 30 years, I just can't give up on accepting what is out there. And I have to know what else out there is being receivable. I have a small portable television, which I took out of my car the other day. That's how I go mobile. I don't put my TV antenna in the car. I use a couple of MagMount VHF antennas or UHF, depending on what I feel like using. And the other day I happened to go out and I went around to the eastern North Fork of the island of Alone, because I'm curious to see what I can pick up in Connecticut. I got quite a few digital channels. I also answered my question of what is my carrier on channel 10. It's actually digital channel 8 coming from New Haven. So I have picked up that one. I picked up quite a few from up there. So my question just keeps on going on. Once I can rotate my antenna on top of my actual house, I'll be much happier. But whether I can get all these channels to my house, I don't know if I can or can't. But this just sort of answered my curiosity question of what I can pick up on the North Shore of Long Island.
Understand. Sounds like fun. And keep it up. You're obviously displaying curiosity, and that's where the progress comes from. You want somebody to make technological progress, choose a curious man, give him the right amount of time, the right amount of test equipment, the right amount of challenge. How does radio really work? How does digital television really work? What equipment works? In what locations? Gives me what kind of performance? Curiosity. That's how mankind makes progress. And a significant percentage of the really performing ham radio operators are the guys with the technical curiosity. Keep it up, Joe. And the next guy who signed in, I think, was Eugene, EWK. And I'm not sure if he said yes, he had a question, but I'm going to give Eugene a chance. He asked us some extremely challenging questions last week, and we weren't able to give him answers. Thank goodness we've discontinued the prize committee that Mel had there for a while. For a while, if you stumped the experts that were present, we would give you a meal ticket for you and your significant other at a local restaurant when you stumped the experts. So we've had to discontinue that, giving away too many meals. So, Eugene, go easy with us because we had a tough time with your questions last week. W2EWK, the voice of Pat Shaw, K2LAW in the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick, very good. This is W2EWK. Well, last week I got my Ring amplifier hooked up, and I got everything all hooked up perfect now. Only thing I have to do now is to hook up into my ICOM 7000, but everything is okay, though. I called to say I support the net a little while ago. I was supporting the net, okay? So, everything over here is up the dory. My car is going real good. But so many people on the road would like to buy my car. I keep on saying, it's not for sale. To the right person comes by with the proper money, but I'm keeping that car maybe for a lifetime. Who knows? Okay, Dick. Risky
2
Echo, Risky
Kilo,
right back to you,
though. Yeah, it turns out that I did the same thing, Eugene. Each one of the cars that I've owned over the last 30 years, I bought them used, about 5 years old, and kept them. And each time I bought a 5 or an 8-year-old car, the person I'm buying it from thought the car was at end of life. And I drive it for another 8 years or so. I don't give up until I have rust in the floor and things like that. I hang in there to the point that it's a little bit crazy. And if I go to a fine restaurant where they do valet parking, I park across the street. I don't want them to see the car that I arrive in. Well, thank goodness the car that I've got now is a nice shiny one. For the first time, I bought a used car that was only a couple of years old and in real good shape. But I used to drive some pretty yucky looking rattle traps. I used to drive mostly station wagons because I wanted a whole lot of area on the roof for aerials and a whole lot of volume inside to carry a whole lot of hardware around. And now I drive a 4-door sedan. Good luck with that. I think we've gone to all the people who signed in with questions. I hope I haven't skipped anyone. Once I confirm that, Mel and I are going to tell you a little bit about what we've run into this week and our philosophy, slight shift in philosophy. What emails I've gotten. I know Mel's gotten even more emails. We've created a couple of controversies, and we're going to tell you what our opinion on all this is. So did I miss anyone who signed in with a question or a comment? Give me your words right now just to make sure. K2LAW in the TechNet. Okay, that's good. I think I did not. Now, I've had email this week, and Mel's got a lot more of it because he gets more than I do. And bear in mind now that the whole purpose of the TechNet is it's a live consultation service of a kind. Mel is an electrical engineering consultant. I'm an electrical engineering consultant. We've each got 35 years of experience in electronics, primarily radio electronics and high-speed video and whatever. So you're getting a kind of consulting service when you listen to Mel, Dick, and their friends on the air live consulting. It's what you're sort of getting. The price is right. When it comes to written material that was sent, we make no promises. You're at your own risk if you send in an email. I mean, some of the emails we've sent are very complimentary. We've had guys send us emails in which the guy is doing graduate-level research for his master's or doctorate degree in college, and he's asking us a zillion questions on an email that would help him in the research he's doing. It's flattering that they ask us that level of questions, but there's a catch. We have not volunteered to give free written consulting service. Do it live, on the spot, with the help of our friends. I type in 5 or 15 words a minute. I'm a slow typer. I can talk 150 words a minute when I get excited, and with the help of our friends, we can get you answers. I'm not volunteering to try to understand your questions and write back long explanations of the philosophy of the universe and how electronics work. So when you write us an email, you're doing it at your own risk. There is no promise you're going to get an answer. However, the email does give us a hint as to how we're being received. And the answer is occasionally we get grief because